This is London Calling.
Hi, I'm Graham Mack, and welcome to the programme, and my special guest, Engelbert Humperdinck, a giant of show business who's worked with some of the biggest names in entertainment, including Jerry Lewis, Dean Martin, and Elvis Presley.
Elvis was a wonderful man. I'm going to tell you that right from my heart. He was one of the greatest entertainers I've ever met in my life, and to me, the best stage performer I have ever seen.
He said something really nice to you as well, something very touching.
Yeah. Yes, he did. He said that Engelbert reminded him of the twin brother he lost at birth.
More from Engelbert Humperdinck soon. But first, a look ahead to a lady who's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks' time. Kim Wilde was huge in the UK in the 80s. She had 17 chart hits. She even had a number one in America with You Keep Me Hanging On. She's back with a new tour and a new album called Here Come the Aliens. It's called that because of an incident in 2009. After taking her son to accident and emergency at the hospital, she came back to her Hertfordshire home and witnessed a UFO.
So, you know, everyone will say, oh yeah, you were on the wine, Kim, blah, blah, blah. So actually, no, I wasn't. I was actually, if you remember, 2009 was when swine flu was everywhere. And we were really worried with our son Harry was quite young at the time and looked like he probably had it. And we took him to Ernie. So we were there all night till about 10:30, but it was still light because it was in June. So it was still dusk, very light, and we saw these lights in the sky when I got back. So I hadn't been out at home all night on the Pinot Grigio. I'd actually been, you know, just at the local A&E doing an amazing job like they always do. Anyway, so there I was, sitting in the garden, looking up into a Hertfordshire sky, and these... Actually, you know what happened first, Graham, was that some helicopters came over in a very... and from a direction they never come in, and quite low in a way they never normally do, with a bright light surrounding them. And I just presumed they were... On the run, you know, looking for a wrong un.
Right, I thought. So you thought it was the police? It was the cops.
I thought it was the cops. I thought that's what it was. So I was sat in the garden waiting for some wrong un to come running up the garden, and then they disappeared. And it was completely silent, dusk, still a bit of sun at the back of, you know, into the west, and a bit of low cloud into the direction I was looking. And that's when I saw the light. And I saw the light, literally. And I was with a mate of mine and my husband, and we walked down to look at it. And then it started doing this really astonishing stuff where, because I couldn't see it, I could just see the light it was making through low cloud. And then it went from...
So what did it look like? What shape was it?
It was, well, it was a circular light. It was a glowing light like you would see if you saw the sun through cloud or a moon through cloud. Except that it suddenly started moving really rapidly, like with a blink of an eye, from, say, about an 11 o'clock position to about 2. And then back to 11, then back to 2, then back to 11. Then a smaller one started following it. So then it was started being like two somethings were doing something with bright lights up in the sky. I could definitely see it wasn't anything coming from Nebworth House. You know, I thought maybe they were having a bit of a party and getting the lights out. But I knew it wasn't them. I checked up to make sure there was an event that night. There wasn't. Just because I was so completely flabbergasted by what I saw. But I did meet people locally who saw also something, actually saw it, in fact. I didn't see it, I saw the light it made, but I did see people, I did meet people who saw something very strange that night.
You're convinced it was aliens?
I'm convinced it was aliens. I'm convinced that they've been visiting this planet for many, many thousands upon thousands of years, that they're probably resident in some part of our planet at some, or have been at some point, or are. I don't know. I haven't been in contact with them, so I haven't got a clue what they're thinking. I don't have any special insight into their psyche, but I know what I saw. And I also felt whatever was up in the sky was massive. So I'm not talking like a little Chinese lantern.
Or what, are we talking like, when you say massive, are we talking the size of a car or the size of a building?
A building. Or bigger. Yeah. It was massive. Whatever it was up there was massive.
Wow.
I felt it was massive.
Yeah.
I could feel almost the air being displaced around me when I was standing on the grass. And I said that to my friend at the time. I said, try and think of a word before this stops. Think of a word to help describe this. And we both said momentum, because at the moment it moved from 11 o'clock to 2 o'clock, we felt the whole place move. It was like it displaced all the air. It was massive, you know. Yeah. So as a result, I went off and, totally stunned. And I've ended up making an album called Here Come the Aliens.
More from Kim Wilde in a couple of weeks' time. So let's have a look at what's going on in Britain. Well, the most wasted food in Britain is salad that's delivered when you order a takeaway meal. 94% of salads delivered to British homes with a takeaway meal are thrown straight in the bin. The weird thing is, some people in the 6% that doesn't go straight in the bin give it straight back to the delivery driver. I didn't even know you could do that. Bonzi.
Right. Thrown away food. Wasted food.
Yes.
Now I know you can give it back to the driver. I will.
I didn't know that. He was saying...
Well, I'll just say. That's a tip, mate. Yeah, it's a tip of the iceberg.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
No. The tip of the iceberg. Oh, dear.
That'll
oh,
do.
Dear.
Ta-da.
And now news from Canada.
He's a lumberjack and he's okay. Sleeps all night and he works all day.
Hey, how's this waiter in Vancouver? He's French and the restaurant he works for have fired him for being rude. He said, you can't do that. I'm not rude. I'm French. This is how we are. We're direct. You're being culturally insensitive. Are the French rude? Julie.
You say the French are rude.
No, wait a second. I'm not saying the French are rude. A French waiter is saying the French are rude, and he's been fired in it from his job in Canada for being rude, and he's saying, I can't help it, we're French. Stop being so culturally insensitive. So I just want to make it clear, I'm not saying the French are rude.
Okay.
I just like to know from your experience, what have you found?
Okay. Well, I had to go up to London yesterday for a hospital appointment, and I actually found it was mostly the English people that were so rude, pushing, shoving, just trying to get to where they needed to be super fast.
Yes.
And in fact, on the train, on the way back, it was so packed, and there were people tutting and swearing, and it was actually the foreign people that were so polite, would you like to sit down, would you like to get off before me? So I actually think it was the English yesterday that were extremely rude.
So do you think the idea that the French are rude has come from the fact that English people have visited France, they've been obnoxious, and of course the French have been rude to obnoxious people, and we've blamed the French?
Quite possibly.
Okay,
quite
thanks possibly. A lot, Julie. Darren's on the phone. What can I do for you, Darren?
Oh, yeah, I just thought while you was on the subject of France, I'll give you a did you know.
Okay.
Yeah, did you know that the very first beach footwear was invented by a Frenchman?
Really?
Yeah, called Philippe Philop.
Get off! Jim from Philadelphia is on Skype, and Jim, yes, it's that time again. The most ridiculous sporting event there is, the Commonwealth Games. This is where the countries of the Commonwealth compete with each other. And to qualify, it's not necessarily based on athletic ability. You just have to be a country that was formerly ruled by Britain.
Yes.
As long as that happened to you, you can qualify. You can play. That's just the silliest reason
ever. Yes, that's the only qualification. Yes.
Yeah. Just silly. Because, you know, they are literally from every corner. There are African nations. There are South Pacific nations, European. There's even Canada. I mean, it's just the silliest reason ever for games. When we had an empire, maybe there'd be a point then, because then you could see which is the best nation at sport in the entire empire. It was called the Empire Games. That made sense. But the Commonwealth Games, it's like, oh yeah, we're the Commonwealth. What is that? Oh, it's a trading partnership. Really? Well, you tell Australia and New Zealand that about when we joined the EU back in the 70s, how they felt about that trading relationship.
Yes.
Commonwealth.
Yes. So what do we have in common? We were all right. Once owned by Britain. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah.
We all We all kind of want to forget that yeah. part of our history.
Yeah.
But okay, fine. Let's celebrate it once a year with games.
Yeah. And varying degrees, you know. It depends on whether you were originally from European stock or you're one of the indigenous people. Now, I'm sure the Aborigines are not real keen on the fact that that Australia competes in the Commonwealth Games and what it represents. India, perhaps. Certainly parts of Africa. So, therefore, I'm still saying Commonwealth Games is racist. Because all of those countries, the indigenous people of every one of those countries, the North American Red Indians, or whatever they're called now, Native Canadians. Are they still Native Americans? What are Canadian
Native
Indians
Native Americans,
called?
Yeah.
Are Canadian Indians Native Americans? Surely they're Native Canadians.
I guess.
I don't. But anyway, the indigenous people of each one of those regions represented cannot be happy about this. We're trying to forget this and build bridges, not celebrate it. I just don't know. Celebrate it with a festival of sport? I don't get the Commonwealth Games.
Well, I guess the only good thing is at least we're not shooting each other. we're just competing.
Do they have shooting in the Commonwealth Games, and what exactly do you shoot? That is what I want to know.
No, more importantly, what's the target?
Yes. Yes. Oh, I see. So the British shooter is against the Indian shooter, but he's not shooting at Indians. Okay. He's not shooting at Aborigines. He's not shooting at Maoris. He's not shooting at the Maori Ori or the Mau Mau. He is not shooting at the Zulu. That's good to know. Huge sigh of relief from the Zulu warriors who've come all prepared. Maybe the Commonwealth Games should be the indigenous people of each of the nations versus the British. It's as a revenge thing. They compete in all different events against the British just to see if they could even the score. Well, you may have taken our homes and raped our women and torched our things and taken our livelihoods and sugar plantations and all the rest of it. But
yes, but who's better at cricket?
You got us. Prince Charles is a hipper twit. It's been announced that Britain will bring in a return fee for bottles so that they're recycled. You'll be charged extra for a bottle or a can, and then you'll get money back when you return it. So Prince Charles has got behind this scheme. He's making out that he's an environmentalist. He's half right. He's a mentalist. This is a bloke who's had nothing to do with this. He used up to 7 months' worth of the average British person's carbon footprint on one flight, flying to Copenhagen in an executive jet. And you know why he was going there? To make a speech on climate change. Jason.
Right, Prince Charles.
Yes, the hypocritical twit. The bloke who flies a helicopter round and drives around in Range Rovers and then starts telling us that we should all be recycling stuff to save the planet. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you got that, and then you got Kim Jong-un,
yes,
who's dedicated to denuclearization.
So he says, yeah, he wouldn't need to denuclearize if he didn't nuclearize in the first place.
Exactly. I think it must be in the job description of prime ministers, MPs, royal families, all that sort of thing. Are you hypocritical and can you talk a load of bull? Yes, I can. You're hired.
That's all it takes. But it's our fault for swallowing it and not standing up and going, wait a minute. I don't know how they're getting away. That's why they're getting away with it, is because not enough people like you and I are standing up to these people.
I know.
We need to call them out.
Hope for a while. But he's covering up his stuff that people have already said about doing. He's just jumping on the bandwagon.
Well, that's really? all the royals do when people go, oh, they work very hard. They work very hard getting publicity for themselves. That's all they do. Princess Diana attached herself to all kinds of charities, including landmines. In fact, she spent one day in a war zone. She goes to an AIDS hospital and she meets patients and stuff. She's the patron of different charities. Do you know how much she left to those charities? In fact, do you know how much she left to charity in her will, to any charity at all? Do you know how much she left?
Not a clue.
Not a penny. Not zero. Nothing. They don't care about these organizations. They just use them to get PR for themselves. And this is how the game is played, and we're all too stupid to see it. And all our tax money is going to fund these idiots.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Thanks a lot, Jason.
Thank you, Graham.
It's a real time of transition for Julie and I. We moved to the UK 21 years ago, and in all that time, we've always rented. Right now, we're in the process of buying an apartment. It's a new build, so it's small. That means we have to say goodbye to a lot of cool things that we've collected over the years because they just won't fit. This week, we said an emotional goodbye to our Doctor Who pinball machine. I don't know its full history, but I know it lived in an arcade in Blackpool before it was rescued by a place called Pinball Heaven, who refurbished it. We bought it from them about 18 years ago, and it stood in the living room of flats and houses we've rented all over Britain. Removal men have sweated and grunted over it as we've moved around the country. From time to time, I've dismantled and reassembled various bits of it, soldered broken joints, replaced solenoids, bulbs, the motherboard, and the rubber bits around the flippers and all the bumpers. Thankfully, you can fix a Doctor Who pinball machine without needing a sonic screwdriver. We've played hundreds of games on it, and once I got a score so high that it let me add my initials to its list of high-scoring Time Lords. When that happens, the big Dalek on the top gets really grumpy and says, "Next time, Doctor, you will not be so lucky." We sold it on eBay for more than twice what we paid for it. So the news isn't all bad. And we're moving to a really nice brand new apartment that we'll own and we can do what we like with. It'll open up a whole new episode of our lives together. Just like the Doctor. It's time for us to regenerate. Of course, we're fascinated in Britain about the big news coming from the US of A. God bless America! Yes, the Stormy Daniels affair. She says her and Donald did it. He says they didn't. What do you reckon, Bonzi?
Who are you going to believe? The fake blonde with the big boobs? Or Stormy Daniels?
Get off! Let's check in with Vince.
The royal family, you either love them or you don't love them, and I'm sure they bring a lot of pleasure to a lot of people. But why do people insist that they're normal people?
Yeah.
Kate was seen shopping in Waitrose on her own, and she's heavily pregnant.
Yeah.
In the real world, there's thousands of people who are heavily pregnant and haven't got a nanny at home looking after your other two children for you.
And live in extreme opulence and travel everywhere in a helicopter.
Yeah, exactly.
And making out that a pregnant woman does her shopping, that's not news.
It's not news,
there's an old man, the Duke of Edinburgh, he's having a hip operation, and he was filmed going into hospital wearing a ridiculous coat and bowler hat. Not news. Old man gets a hip replacement. Pregnant woman goes shopping in Waitrose. These are not news stories. It's ridiculous the way that the media coverage of the royal family bothers me more than the royal family, because the media, the news media in particular, is supposed to be impartial. They never mention how much the royal family cost and what a bunch of parasites they are. They never give you the other side of the story. They're all just royal sycophants. It's disgusting.
Well, nobody ever dares to, except yourself, to say anything about them.
yeah, but anyway.
You'll be in the tower.
Yeah, it's only a matter of time. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Vince. Thank you.
No problem.
Cheers. Let's get to my main guest. It's Arnold George Dorsey, who changed his name to Engelbert Humperdinck. He's been described as one of the finest middle-of-the-road balladeers around. His singles Release Me and The Last Waltz both topped the UK charts in 1967 and sold more than a million copies each. In North America, he's also had chart success with After the Lovin' and This Moment in Time. He sold more than 150 million records worldwide. Engelbert, welcome to London Calling. And I've met you. It was about 10 years ago. I was doing the breakfast show at a radio station in the East Midlands, Century Radio.
Oh.
And the radio station had a box at the race course. And Russell Parrott, who was in charge at the time, he says, "You'll never guess who's in the box next to you." And we said, "Who?" And he said, "It's Engelbert Humperdinck." And we're like, "Oh, wow." He says, he said, "Would you like to meet him?" And I said, "Oh, that would be okay." So we went in and he asked you and you invited us into your box and you couldn't have been lovelier. I've got a picture of you and me and my wife. So thank you very much for your hospitality on that day. It really was a thrill for all of us.
Oh, you are.
So where do you live these days?
Well, you know, I still live in Leicester. I still have a home there, in Great Glen. But I'm living in Los Angeles now, you know, in L.A. Because, as you, I think you may know about my wife's condition.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't travel very much, very well. So therefore, I keep her in that same environment, you know, with a little bit of sunshine so that she is, she can have all her medications and all her treatments, or you know, regularly. So hopefully for a great new start in her life again, you know.
Yeah, this is Patricia. She's been suffering from Alzheimer's. How is she doing?
She's making some progress slowly. It's a slow situation. You know, you can't get rid of that plaque in a hurry. It's very, very difficult, you know. So they do have a method of doing it with ultrasound or whatever it is, but that breaks it up too much and it can be too detrimental to the patient because it causes a stroke, you know. So I'm not doing that yet. I'm trying to do it the way she's been doing it now with acupuncture and stem cells.
Right. So that'll take up a lot of your time and it must be a very difficult time for you.
Well, it is because, you know, unfortunately she's been struck with this terrible disease, but hopefully, you know, there is going to be a cure in the near future. But the cure, what she's doing now is healthy because she has started to talk a little bit now. She's starting to talk again, which is wonderful. She hasn't talked for a couple of 3 years, you know.
So that's good news, yeah.
It is very good news, which means the treatment is working. And I went public with it for the simple reason. It was kind of a little bit on my part, you know, I felt it's necessary to come because people were asking questions. They were saying, well, you know, you never travel with your wife anymore. You did that. So it's to stop the curiosity of what's going on, I came out with it.
There's a song on your new album, and the song is called Just the Way You Are.
Yeah.
When you sing that, are you dedicating that to Patricia?
That is one of the songs that is dedicated. The whole album is a dedication to my wife, but because she has two songs. One was specially written for her called Just Like the First Time.
Yeah.
And written by a Brit, you know, and I thought it's a wonderful song because I met my wife when she was 17 years old. And we've been dancing together ever since. And then there's the other song, which is the duet, which I do with my granddaughter, which was written by my daughter. And it's all dedicated to my wife.
And that's the one, I'm glad I danced with you.
Yeah. Have you heard it?
Yeah, it's lovely. And Olivia's terrific in it too.
She's only 9. She's 9 years old.
She really is terrific.
Yeah, she's. I mean, she phrases like she's in her 20s, you know.
Yeah.
But she's a very quick learner, and she loves listening to people, you know, like Ariana Grande, and she likes listening to. She likes Whitney Houston a lot, you know, that sort of music she's into.
Yeah. Well, she does a lovely job on it. And do you ever get emotional when you're singing songs about Patricia?
Of course I would. I mean, there's that when I sang. Just like the first time, it was tough for me to record it.
Yeah,
it was tough recording that one. I'm glad I danced with you, of course, my little granddaughter makes me feel comfortable when she's with me on stage singing now.
And she goes all right in front of a crowd? She doesn't get too nervous?
Well, you know, she's at that stage now, and you know, the young ones now have developed a confidence that I never had when I was that young. You know? She's quite comfortable on stage, which is very great. You know, as I said to Bruno Mars when he performed for me when he was a little boy at 5 years old, it was in Hawaii, and the fan club threw a end of the year party for me. And the entertainment they had was Bruno Mars, a little five-year-old boy. And I said to him then, I said, young man, you're going to be a big star. But he's not a big star. He's a mega star now, you know. But I can see the talent right there and then, as I have seen it in my granddaughter now.
Well, he's almost as big a name as Engelbert Humperdinck, but not quite, not yet.
Bruno's massive. He's around the world now.
Yeah.
He's a massive name. He's a massive name, yeah.
Can I go back to the beginning then, Engelbert? You were born in India, and your father worked as an engineer in the British Army. You didn't return to England till you what?
I was 10.
Oh, you were 10. So what were your impressions of England at that stage then?
Well, you know, I hadn't seen snow or anything like that in my life, but it was very exciting knowing that I was coming to a place where, you know, my father's and mother's families were, and when we came in... I mean, it was exciting for me. It really was, you know. We had the wrong clothes, obviously, because we had to keep warm. We came in the wintertime.
Yeah.
But we had soon altered all that. We got the clothes to match, and everything was fine after that. But we had to stay at my auntie, my father's sister's house until my dad had found a place for us, you know.
Yeah. And then how old were you when you first got interested in music?
I started getting interested in music when I was a little boy. You know, I mean, when I was about 5 or something, I could play in the mood on the piano with one hand. And I started to sing with my family.
Yeah.
My eldest sister taught me how to sing harmony. So I would be the person singing harmony and out of the group of children, you know, and I didn't sing melody till I was quite older. And I went into a club in Leicester, and I sang a song, and I got a standing ovation. They wanted to know who my agent was. I said, I'm not even in show business. So that's what started the whole ball rolling. And I started working little clubs and gaining experience. And here I am today, you know, talking to you about my career of 50 years.
So when did you become Jerry Dorsey? Because you were Arnold George Dorsey, weren't you?
I was Arnold, then I changed it to Jerry because I thought, you know, this is an easy name to say.
Yeah.
And at that particular time, I was doing impressions as well, so I could do impression of Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis and, you know, and Frankie Vaughan. And you had to do that in order to get work. You had to be other than a singer, you know.
Right. It was cabaret.
Yeah. It was like a cabaret thing. And so therefore, I don't do impressions now, but because I have a multitude of music to sing, you know. Especially with this new album, the show I'm doing, I'm singing at least 8 songs from the album.
Yeah.
So that's quite a big chunk of music. It's nearly 45 minutes of the new album I do, and the rest of it will be my standards that people have come to know and that I do.
There's a few standards on the new album though, isn't there? I mean, there's Crazy, the Willie Nelson song, and On Broadway, The Drifters hit, and Welcome to My World, Jim Reeves. Why did you decide to put those on the album as well as the newer stuff?
Because that's the stuff I do in my show.
Right. So you wanted the hardcore fans to still get Engelbert?
Yes, a little bit, yes. And it's a very unusual Broadway song. You know, I mean, it's the epitome of what Broadway stands for.
Yeah.
And that's why I do it on stage. And the arrangement was done by Johnny Harris, a Brit arranger. And he just did an amazing job on it. He did that arrangement. He did Follow My Heart. He did Man I Want to Be.
Yeah.
He did the Crazy.
Yeah.
He's an amazing arranger. And I've known him for a lot. He was the one who did the arrangement for Quando Quando for me.
Right.
Yeah, so it goes back that far, but 49 years.
Yeah, I mean, you've just got so many years to look. I mean, you're 82 next birthday in May. And when I played the album to my wife, she said, wow, his voice really has held up. Is there a trick? Do you have to really look after your voice? Because it still just sounds superb.
No, not at all. I've done nothing to my voice. I've never had a singing lesson in my life, and everything is natural. But, you know, as you get older, your voice changes and your vibrato gets slower and you lose your range and everything. But nothing is like that has happened to me. I'm very fortunate. I'm touching wood as I say that, you know.
When you first started out, I mean, you were doing okay as Jerry Dorsey, but then your first single didn't really do anything, did it? It was a flop.
It was, yeah.
It wasn't until you got the new manager and you got the new name.
That's right.
So that was Gordon Mills, wasn't it? He was Tom Jones' manager, and he also went on to do...
Gilbert O'Sullivan.
It was Gilbert O'Sullivan as well. So how important was he to you then?
Oh, he was very important because, I mean, Gordon was the one that gave all three of us our names, you know?
Yeah.
He gave me my name, he gave Tom Jones his name, and he gave Gilbert O'Sullivan his name. So he christened us all with new names, and we were all in the stable together. And I was there till 1976 until I separated from him because I felt that, you know, I felt that he was more partial to the Jones boy than he was to me. And I said, you know, I don't need that. So I went on my own.
He had a bit of a gambling problem, though, didn't he? Did that affect you?
It did affect me. He was using our money. But he was a big gambler. But the only reason why he could be that big is because he was using other people's money.
Yeah. Did you ever get any of it back?
Not really. Not really.
Now, just before that, though, your career almost derailed, didn't it? Because you had tuberculosis. This is 1961, and you were out of commission for 6 months. What were things like when you came back?
Very dull. It was difficult for me to get back, and people knew you had tuberculosis. They didn't want to get close to you because it was a disease. And in that day, in today's world, it's nothing. You know, it's a walk-in. You can walk and have this complaint.
Yeah.
But not then. Then you had to lie on your back for 6 months. And it took me a year and a half of convalescing before I could even try to sing again.
And how had the music business changed in that time?
Well, the music has changed. It changes all the time, you know, and it had changed at that particular era. And then when I came back, before that, I was on musical shows like Oh Boy and Drumbeat and all these lovely things, you know, as Jerry Dorsey.
Yeah.
And then when I came back, I was trying to make a name for myself. I moved to London, and that's where I met Gordon Mills on a tour.
Yeah.
You know, we did tours, rock and roll tours together. And then he found Jones, and by accident, through one of his good friends, he found him. And he had, you know, he started his career off first, and then I was, a year later, it was me.
Do you still get on with Tom Jones?
I haven't seen Tom Jones in 30-odd years.
Oh, really?
No.
Is that kind of your idea or his?
No, it wasn't my idea. I think it was his. He doesn't want to be involved with anybody else. So, you know, he's quite a loner. And he didn't need my company. So, I mean, it's fine with me. You know.
Was he okay when you had the big hit in 67 with Release Me?
We were fine then, yeah. Everything was fine, yeah. But, you know, It's his loss. I'd rather be a friend than be an enemy, you know.
Well, maybe he's listening and maybe he'll give you a call.
Maybe. Yeah.
I mean, things really did take off in 67 after Release Me. It rocketed to the top of the British charts. It kept the Beatles, Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields forever off the top. And then a streak, I mean, 7 straight top 5 UK hits lasted till 1969. And then Vegas came calling, and that's when it was Dean Martin was a big help there, wasn't he?
He certainly was. I played his hotel the Riviera, and he put his name on the marquee, you know, Dean Martin presents Engelbert Humperdinck, and I'm the only one he ever did it for in his hotel.
Yeah.
So I was very thrilled with that. And we became very good friends, you know.
Yeah.
Dean and I, we dined together many, many a time at the La Familia restaurant in Los Angeles. And he never called me Angel or Engel, and he always called me Humpy Bumpy Lumpy Dumpy.
Was that okay with you?
It was fine with me. I loved him. And he always, I tell you what, I had a home in Las Vegas on the desert and golf course, and he never liked heights, and it was a bungalow styled house. And he would rent that home for his stays in Vegas. He would stay at my home there.
Yeah. And you're also mates with Elvis as well when you're in Vegas, because Elvis was doing big business at that time too, the early 70s.
Yes, he did. And we became friends, and he'd see my show, I'd see his show. And I learned a lot from watching him. He was a very humble man. And when he met me, he didn't shake my hand, he gave me a hug, you know, and that was wonderful. And that was the start of a friendship.
What was it like appearing on stage where you're the main attraction and then Elvis walks into the room? How does that work?
I tell you what, I was very thrilled that Elvis came to see my show. And when I introduced him, he stood on the table and he opened his cloak and he like Batman, you know, and it was just, for 10 minutes or more, the whole place was in an uproar, you know,
yeah.
And it took me all that time to quieten the audience. And I finally said, shh, Elvis, this is my show. Yeah. And of course we had a laugh about it later on in the dressing room. And it was just wonderful, wonderful. Elvis was a wonderful man. I'm going to tell you that right from my heart. He was one of the greatest entertainers I've ever met in my life. And the best stage performer I have ever seen.
He said something really nice to you as well, something very touching.
Yeah, yes, he did. He said that, Engelbert reminded him of the twin brother he lost at birth.
Wow. That's pretty high praise. Yeah.
Yeah, yes, it is.
And then he stole your sideburns.
Yeah, he did that. After me, though. He stole it, yes, right after. A few years after I'd had mine on for a while, yes. He made it bigger than I did. You know, because he was such a major star, you know.
Yeah.
He made it huge. But before he had that white suit outfit that he became famous for in his last years, somebody was sketching an outfit out for him, which was going to be the white suit. And it was a she. And she showed it to him when he was singing. He took it and he knelt down and he took it in his hand. And the camera caught the thing and he said, "Hell, that's not me. That's Engelbert Humperdinck." She'd grown in his sideburns, you see.
And at the time, could you tell that, because it, you know, this was probably only 7 years before he died. Could you tell that he was starting to lose? I mean, there've been many books written about Elvis and just what happened to him. Were you ever worried for him?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. I saw him in the last stages, in the last few months. I went to see one of his shows, and when he came out, he looked really bad. You know, he looked very pale and sweating a lot. And I was very worried at that point in time. And then a few months later, he was gone.
Where were you when you found out?
I was in Lake Tahoe, and I used to do a number called The Trilogy, and Elvis was famous for his trilogy. So I stole that piece of music, and I started to sing it in my show. And when I heard he passed away, that was a piece of music I closed the show with. When I'd do my last number, the curtain would close, and then they would be playing the music, and then the curtain would open, and they would either stand there, and I would sing The Trilogy as my encore. But that particular night, the curtain opened and I wasn't there. I couldn't do it. I physically wasn't there. I didn't go on to do that number. It was too painful.
Well, for more than 60 years, you've been at the top of the showbiz ladder. You've duetted with everybody. Gloria Gaynor, you won a Golden Globe Entertainer of the Year Award. You did a song for the Beavis and Butthead Do America soundtrack. You've done a contemporary dance album. You've done duets with everyone on that album, the one where you did Elton John, Smokey Robinson. You put out a greatest hits record to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Release Me.
What about Gene Simmons? That was cool
from Kiss. Yeah. How did that happen?
Well, I don't know. He just wanted to do it with me, so I was happy to have him. He was great in the studio. He was absolutely wonderful in the studio.
Do you ever think about retiring, Engelbert?
I never think about it, my friend. I never think about it. I love what I do. I don't do too many concerts a year, about 70 or 80 concerts a year. But it's around the world, you know?
At the age of 81, you're traveling the world and doing, you say you're only doing 71 concerts a year. What would the number used to be?
It used to be about 140, 150.
Wow.
Yeah. And in the early days, when I first began, in the 60s and 70s, late 60s, I was doing 300 shows a year.
Goodness me.
Yeah.
And that was shows. There was also TV shows as well as that, because you were on Dean Martin's show. You were on with your Jerry Lewis, who you did impression of, but who became your friend.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, wow.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's been a great life, hasn't it?
It's been wonderful. I hope it never ends.
And the new album is out now. It's called The Man I Want to Be, which is a great track. Why did you decide to use that title as the title for the album?
Well, the story is, it's a great storyline on that particular track, you know. Besides that, I really don't know who the man I want to be.
Really?
Yet. I'm still trying. I'm still trying to be somebody that I, you know, and once I've reached that, I don't want to ever stop trying to be somebody, you know, to be something. I don't want to stop trying. I want to keep trying until I find satisfaction. I'm not satisfied yet with my career. But this album has given me that little bit of more satisfaction and comfort than ever before.
Well, it's a wonderful album. Tell me about the song Our England.
Well, that was written by my good friend Les Reed.
Mm-hmm.
Les was written The Last Waltz for me, Les Basic, Let the Bells Eyes, you know, and many, many other hits for me. Had this song up his sleeve, and he sent it to me. He said, are you interested in recording a song for our country? And I listened to it, and I said, damn right I am. It's a wonderful song, and I'm happy to be doing it. And that's what we did. It's a song that could be sung at, you know, soccer matches, football matches, and, you know, and sung for celebrative occasions.
Now, you don't sing that one when you're on stage in America, though, do you?
Oh, no, you can't do that. You have to sing it in your own country. But it is on the album. It is on the album, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
The album, The Man I Want to Be, is out now. It's been wonderful talking to you, Engelbert. Continued success. I hope it goes well. And I hope at the age of 81, you find out who the man you want to be is. And I hope you become that man. Engelbert Humperdinck, thank you so much.
You're welcome, my friend. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, that's it for this one. Back with another one soon. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on Apple Podcasts. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. If you put your phone number in the email, I might call you back. I might Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.